Chapter 2, starting in verse 1 to verse 11. John chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. The mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now became wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him.
To see everyone here this morning, we're grateful for everyone that's here. We have visitors that are amongst us, and we are grateful for your seeking us out and deciding to be with us, worshiping God with us today. And we encourage you to come back any opportunity you may have to do so, to be with us, and so we can meet you again. One of the things when you begin to look at the Gospels and read the narrative that is told to us about Jesus, it becomes readily apparent that the world into which Jesus came just did not know God. Yes, there were some that claimed to. The Pharisees, though, had sucked the very life out of the law of Moses and turned it into nothing more than a form of persecution, and made it nothing more than something that was it was truly a burden for man to keep. The Sadducees, on the other hand, had taken essentially the inspiration out of the old law, and they declared that there was no afterlife, that when man was dead, he was dead all over. And they were only interested in those things that they needed to do in order to retain their power. And so you had this world in which Jesus came in, and they just did not know God at all. And one of the primary tasks of Jesus was to help to instruct the world about the nature of God, to teach them about the Father, teach them about His nature, the things that are important to Him, and that therefore should be important to each one of us. When you read the 4 Gospels, one of the things you note is that you can really take the Gospels and divide them into one of 2 categories. You have what's called the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And they're so called because they basically tell the story of Jesus. Then you have the Gospel of John. And I like to say that while the Synoptic Gospels tell us about the story of Jesus, John tells us about Jesus. And we get to know Jesus very well in reading the Gospel of John. And for that reason, among the 4 Gospels, I would have to say that it's probably my favorite. When you begin to read through the book of John, or the Gospel of John, one of the things that you find is that there are 7 signs that are given by John, or listed in John. The first one being the one that Josh just read to us about, the wedding where water was turned into wine there in John chapter 2. The second one was in 2 chapters later, where Jesus is going to heal a nobleman's son. And then the next chapter after that, in John 5, we read about Jesus healing a lame man. Chapter 6, the very next chapter after that, Jesus feeds 5,000 people. And the same chapter as well, Jesus walks on the water. And then finally we get to, then there is in John chapter 9, you have the healing of the blind man. And then finally in John chapter 11, you have the raising of Lazarus. Seven signs given by John. Each one of these are intended to portray some aspect about Jesus. We're going to look at the first three of these this morning. We're not going to have enough time to look at all seven of them, but we're going to look at the first three of these miracles that John lists. And it's also important to note here, by the way, and not lest anyone think that Randy's mistaken about this, these are not all of the miracles or signs that Jesus did while here on this earth. I dare say that if we were able to count them, there would be thousands of them. And the vast majority aren't even recorded for us. These are just the seven that John chose for purposes of his gospel to make a point about Jesus, each one making a particular point about Jesus himself. But before we get into that, we want to note that when we look at the Gospels themselves, there's an interesting observation to be made about that. We go, for instance, to Acts chapter 2 and verse 22. Peter there, in his sermon on Pentecost, makes this statement, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed throughout him in your midst, just as you yourselves know." Three things that Peter indicates Jesus did, miracles and wonders and signs. When we look at the Gospels, what we find is that the word miracles and signs are used to describe those things that Jesus did. We're going to lay a bit of a foundation before we go into looking at these signs of John. But I'll try not to take too much time to do so. It is an interesting study of the words themselves and where they're found in the Scriptures. But we'll not take too much time to do that. But we want to make this point because it helps us to understand more about what John is telling us here with these signs. First of all, it's looking at these words, miracles and signs. The word miracles itself is generally used by the synoptic writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In fact, they never use the word signs. They always talk about the miracles that Jesus did. They use a Greek word that's translated miracles. And a good example of this is in Matthew chapter 11, verse 20, Jesus began to denounce the cities where most of his mighty works had been done because they did not repent. Now, this is from the English Standard Version, and some of you using the King James, New King James, or the New American Standard in particular, this is translated miracles. It's just that the English Standard Version decides to translate these as mighty works. But this word miracle denotes something that's supernatural. When you look at the various authorities on Greek, and they'll tell you that this word is denoting something in the way of a supernatural event. In other words, it could not have happened naturally in this world. But here's the interesting thing to point out. John never uses this word in anywhere in the Gospel of John. And he uses another word instead to describe the things that Jesus did. Well, what about Jesus himself? What about Jesus himself in looking at talking about the things that he did. Well, Jesus generally talks about the things, his miracles that he worked as works. In John chapter 5, he's making a defense of having healed this lame man on the Sabbath. And he makes the statement, "The testimony I have is greater than that of John," that's John the Baptist, "for the works that the Father has given me to accomplish, the very works that I'm doing, bear witness about me that the Father has sent me." And this word works here, by the way, is in the singular, ergon. I trust that I'm pronouncing that properly. In the plural, it's erga. Those of you who have had science classes will recognize ERG as being a unit of work that is used commonly today in science. And so we borrowed this Greek word work, and what Jesus sees these things as, these miracles, I'm just working. That's what I was sent here to do, was to do work. This is the work I'm paid to do. Now, there's only two exceptions where Jesus ever used anything other than work to describe his the miracles that he performs. One, we're going to see in verse chapter 4 in the healing of the nobleman's son. He makes the statement, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." And then in chapter 6, in verse 26, after he had healed or he had fed the 5,000, he makes this, they came back looking for him. Jesus said, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves." Those are the only two instances in John where Jesus describes his activities, the miracles he's performed, as anything other than the works that he did. But what we find when we begin to look at the Gospel of John is the fact that John always uses the word for signs. If we look at a couple of fairly well-known Greek scholars, they say that this word for signs is a distinguishing mark whereby something is known, an event that is an indication or confirmation of intervention by transcendent powers. That's just a fancy way of saying they were miracles. That's all in the world they're saying there. They're miracles. Supernatural, can't be explained any other way by human science, I guess we would say. And so they're miracles. Now, the word, same word for sign here, as they'll point out, is also used in classical Greek for a token or a signal. That makes it interesting what John would choose to use this word sign instead of a miracle. And we'll see this a little bit later on, just kind of a deeper understanding of what this sign or this signal is. But it's the only word that's used by John for the miracles of Jesus. Many of the seven signs, not everyone, but many of them, he expressly says, this is, for instance, as Josh read here, in verse 11 of chapter 2, he said that this turning the water into wine was the first sign, the first of his signs, at least the ones that that John is listing here in his gospel. The purpose of John in listing all of these signs, he really summarizes for us in a passage many of us are already familiar with. We've read it frequently there at the close of the Gospel of John, where John says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name." One of the things to note about each of these signs or most of these signs, almost every one of them, you'll read that as a result of these signs that John describes, there's an effect on the belief of somebody. As a result of these signs, somebody has their belief strengthened. And they're much stronger, consequently, having seen or witnessed these signs. And that's exactly what he's saying here at the conclusion of his gospel, that is the intention of each of writing this gospel, and that is so that not only that everyone that reads would be able to understand or be able to believe in Jesus Christ and be able to achieve salvation there. Finally, before we begin to look at these signs, I want to note that each of these signs, all seven signs, are intended to demonstrate Jesus' mastery over something. And we're going to look at that. That's going to be the thrust of our lesson this morning, is to look at just what it was that John was demonstrating the mastery of Jesus over in each of these three signs. So we're going to begin by looking at the incident or the miracle, the sign that Josh read to us about there in John chapter 2 and in the first 11 verses there. And what we see as we begin to read through this thing, I want to focus on there in verse 10, the statement that is made by the master of the feast, where the master of the feast tells the bridegroom, "Everyone serves good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." Some translations read, "the best wine." And what the point I want to make here or observe is the fact that Jesus didn't just turn this into any old kind of wine. It was the highest quality of wine. And what we see is being demonstrated here in this miracle, among other things. You could make an argument that Jesus was a master over creation and also over matter. But primarily, Jesus is the master of quality. That Jesus didn't just do a halfway measure in performing this miracle, but rather he provided the best of the wine for this couple and their marriage feast. And I think want to note that, you know, when you begin to look at through the scriptures, everything God, everything Jesus did while he was here on this earth has been of the best quality. For example, God created a perfect world. There are people that will look at what's going on in the world around them and they'll say, "I refuse to believe in a God that would create a world where there's so much suffering and there's so much pain." I have news for you. God didn't create this world as it is. God created a perfect world. Man ruined it when he introduced sin. And because of sin, you now have suffering. You now have disease. And you now have death. And it's not God's fault that the suffering exists. God created a perfect world, but then man got a hold of it and ruined it. God not only created a perfect world, he also created the best plan. He crafted the best plan of salvation. And that is, he came up with a plan of salvation where he provided the sacrifice. And that sacrifice was his very own son. As we sing in the songs frequently, that God gave the best of heaven. And that's absolutely true. Not only that, Jesus made himself the highest quality sacrifice. Jesus didn't shortchange in the very least himself when it came to being the sacrifice. There in the garden, you recall in Matthew 26, he prayed to God, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine or yours. And obviously the answer on that was no, but Jesus didn't just take a sip from that cup. He drank it dry. He suffered the full measure, both before and during his crucifixion. He was the absolute best quality sacrifice, not just in his life, but in what all he had to endure in being that sacrifice. Another example, we could say that God preserved his unerring, his authoritative and complete word, that we have a perfect message from God. It's complete. It's everything we need in order to serve God. And God's preserved us the best quality message. And there's other examples we can point to. When the Israelites were allowed to move into Canaan, God didn't provide them just any old kind of a promised land. He said, look, you move in, you're going to have cities already built. You don't have to build. It's hard enough work today building cities with our powerful equipment. They had to do it by hand. Their cities were already built. Their vineyards were already planted. And God said, all you got to do is just drive the inhabitants out. It's all yours. They didn't have to dig wells. The wells were already dug. God gave it to them. But as typical with man, man ruined it. Not only that, Jesus, in his example, he gave us a high quality example. In fact, it's a perfect example for us to follow here on this earth. And I'm sure some of you can probably come up with other examples of things that God has done that is nothing but the highest quality. So the question I want to ask each one of us today here is, well, what about us? Do we emulate our Master, Jesus Christ, by doing quality work for Him? I want to pose a question for you. Let's suppose you knew in advance, before you arrived here, that when you arrived here today, Jesus Himself was going to be in attendance. That physically he'd be sitting on one of the seats here. Would you have done, I would imagine you might, would you have done anything different yesterday to prepare for today? Would you perhaps made sure you got to bed at a reasonable hour last night? Would you have perhaps made sure you got yourself around in time this morning to be able to be here on time? And I'm not making any kind of judgment here or assessment, but for those of us that participate in the worship service, would you put a little bit more thought into how you were going to lead the congregation in the worship service here among the men, knowing that Jesus was going to be here? If you were, say, a Bible class teacher and you knew that Jesus was going to be sitting in on your class, would you put a little bit more effort into preparing for your class? Or if you're a student, would you study and be prepared so that you don't want Jesus to think you don't really know the material or you don't care about the class. Here's another one. And I can use this example because Becky and I have signed up this month to clean the building. When you clean the building down here, those of us that do that, if you knew Jesus was going to be here, would you do a little extra in making sure that the building was in a good condition? Make sure all the trash is taken care of? Make sure that everything looks nice and clean and presentable? Or maybe we go a little bit deeper than that. If you knew Jesus was going to be here, would it cause you to maybe sign up to clean the building? Just as a sort of a reference, the month of March is taken, already signed up for, but the rest of the year is wide open. Just exactly how much quality do you put into what you give to God? You look at the sacrifice of Jesus, we pointed out that it was the best sacrifice, that Jesus gave the utmost on the cross of Calvary. How do you repay that great sacrifice with slipshod performance in your everyday life? Or we'll try another question here. Do we look for ways to improve on assisting with the cause of Christ? I want to point out here a passage. I think I pointed this out once before. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 through 10. As to the love of the brethren, Paul writes, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed, you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in all Macedonia. Notice this last sentence. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more. Do you hear what Paul's saying there? You're doing a great job of loving the brethren. I want you to improve on that. There's always, brothers and sisters, there's always room for improvement in our service to God. So when you travel, for whatever reason, vacation, for instance, do you take a vacation from serving God, or do you look for opportunities to be able to worship with the local saints, to be able to encourage them? Do you look for ways that you can improve on your life so that you're not a stumbling block to those that are not Christians? Somebody comes to that is brought as a visitor, and it turns out you know that individual, and yet they've heard you tell off-color jokes. Or they would hear you use language you really ought not to use. And you become a stumbling block to being able to lead that individual to Christ. By the way, I just throw this out here. What is the problem with telling jokes of a sexual nature? Is it that God doesn't want you to have a good time, to laugh about something? No, that's not it at all. When we tell jokes of a sexual nature, we demean sex. We belittle it. God created sex as a beautiful thing within a marriage relationship. And we need to remember that and honor God and glorify Him by remembering that jokes using that are themed around sex do nothing but simply belittle sex and make it something as trivial and insignificant. It makes it acceptable between unmarried couples, and it winds up giving that particular impression. Do you work at trying to improve the quality of service you give to God each day? Jesus has demonstrated He is the master of quality. We need to emulate our master in the same way. And look for ways that we can provide better quality for Him with each passing day. Nobleman's son is healed. This is found there in chapter 4. It's right after the story about the woman at the well. And you have a situation there beginning in verse 46 of chapter 4 where there was a nobleman that had a son that was really badly, he was about to die. And he had a fever. This nobleman walked 16 miles from Capernaum to Cana. And he came to Jesus and he said, "Sir, would you please come and heal my son?" And Jesus then tells him that go, your son will live. He doesn't even have to go and to heal him. And this is very interesting because this is in stark contrast to an incident that was recorded in Matthew chapter 8 and also Luke 7 about the Roman centurion's servant who was also ill. And he just sent word. He said, "You know, I believe you have the power. You just speak the word and my servant will be healed. And Jesus said, "Well, you know, I'll come." And no, you just speak the word and it'll be fine. He'll be healed. And Jesus marveled at the faith because he wasn't finding this kind of faith within Israel. Rather, we have here an individual that isn't a Jew, and yet he knew the power of God, knew the power of Jesus, that all he had to do was just speak the word, think it, boom, it happened instantly. What we see here with Jesus healing this nobleman's son, he's the master of distance and space. And by that, space meaning distance, the space between you and me, not outer space. But it's rather he's the master. Jesus doesn't have to be present in order to perform anything. He's also could be said that he's also the master of disease. So what I want to do is to really quickly here, because we're quickly running out of time, we want to ask ourselves the question, do we really believe that God is aware of our difficulties, even though he's in heaven? When we read about in Romans chapter 8, verse 28, a passage we're all familiar with, we know that for those that love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. Unfortunately, people have read that and said, "Oh, that means nothing but good things are going to happen to me." That's not what Paul is saying. You don't have, as we pointed out before, you don't have to go very far into history. Look at the first century. Individuals who were executed for being a Christian, who watched their members of their families torn to pieces simply because they were Christians. You don't have to go very far to see that's not the correct understanding of this passage. What Paul is saying here is that in the end, spiritually, everything's going to work out just fine. Spiritually, everything will be fine. Do we always really believe that, though? When we're going through life and all of a sudden our life is in shambles. Maybe we've lost our job. Maybe we've had to bury a child. Maybe we've had some disease inflicted upon us. Maybe we're having to deal with pain. whether it's from an accident or whether it's from some disease that you've incurred. Do we really believe that God is in control? We need to ask ourselves and be prepared for those bad times when they happen. To say that, yes, indeed, He is in control. We read about stories like this about the nobleman's son being healed. Jesus didn't have to be there in order to know about the suffering that that young man was undergoing and the disease that he had. One of the things to look at in this story also is the faith. Really, there's faith demonstrated here by the father. I know some of the young people have a hard time believing this. But your parents really love you. Here's a man who walked 16 miles. I had a hard time coming up with a good analogy for people here. Ridgecrest to Trona doesn't work. That's more like 24 miles. Even walking Ridgecrest to Randsburg, that's still 21 miles. 16 miles, and it, by the way, it was uphill all the way to Cana. Because you read there in verse 51, he was going down. In the New Testament, when you talk about going down, it's not going down on a map. It's literally going down. If you went from Jerusalem to Jericho, you went down to Jericho because you went down in elevation. This father walked 16 miles, for the most part, uphill in order to ask Jesus to come to Capernaum to heal his son. There's a lot of love there. And he gets there and says, Jesus, would you come heal this, heal my son? And Jesus says, that's okay. He's healed. I don't know about you, but I'd like to have seen something. Maybe Jesus mumble a few words, produce a puff of smoke, produce some kind of a sign that I can look at and say, yeah, okay, I'm... But to be able to say, go home, it's okay, he's cured. It took far more faith for that man to turn around and go back home at that point than it did for him to ever set foot to start on the road to Cana. Do we have that kind of faith? That Jesus said, I know and I care. I'm aware of your sufferings. Moving on to the next chapter, beginning of chapter 5. You have the lame man there at the pool of Bethesda. And as Jesus comes up to the man and he asks, do you want to be healed? And he says, well, there's nobody to put me into the pool when the water's stirred up. By the way, we'll just make a note in passing here. There's nothing in the scriptures to indicate that this understanding this man had was at all accurate, that there was ever any angel or any healing powers associated with it. It was a tradition that they had. But this is put in the text to help us to understand why the man said what he did. And so he said, no, I don't have anybody to put me in there at the pool, and somebody gets there before me, and so I can't. So anyhow, Jesus did and says, hey, just take up your bed and walk. You're healed. This man had been a cripple for 38 years. And what this particular story points to is the fact that Jesus is the master of time and infirmity. You know, we hear doctors or those in the medical community will be familiar with this. You talk about an individual having a stroke. They'll tell you that time is of the essence, that if you don't get them to the hospital quickly, they'll be irreparably damaged, perhaps even die. Or trauma victims. If you can get them to a trauma center quickly, then there's things that can be done for them. But after time goes by, that man's limited in that way. Jesus is not. And in that sense, he's master of time. And he's also demonstrated here that he's master of infirmity because he's able to heal the man instantly, saying, take up your bed and walk. I think I'd also like to point out here the fact that, again, we see an example, at least to me, that of Jesus and equality that he does, that he performs in anything. He said to the man, do you want to be healed? Better translation says, do you want to be made whole? And what that tells me is that this individual, if he may have had a heart condition as well, that got fixed. When Jesus made him whole. If he had little arthritis in the shoulders, maybe, but that got fixed too. Jesus did not do halfway jobs. It was of the highest quality in everything that he did. So I want to ask the question, do we really believe that God alone can make us whole physically? Is that just something that doctors do? Or does God really play a part in making me whole physically when I'm suffering from any kind of ailment? Do I really believe that God alone can make me whole spiritually? There are some people, and here's what I mean by that. There are some people that believe there's no way they can really understand the Bible without someone that's had years at a seminary to tell them what the Bible means. Now, I'm not denying the story or the principle laid out there by the Ethiopian eunuch there in Acts chapter 8, where Philip was able to help the man to better understand the Bible. An Old Testament passage, it was a prophecy of Jesus. And I'm not denying that we can help each other perhaps to better understand the Scriptures, but to be able to understand the basic requirements for being saved, you don't need someone with a degree in theology to tell you what the Bible means. What you need to do in order to put yourself in a right relationship to God. And furthermore, beyond that, do we really believe these? Do we really want them to do this? There are some people out there that don't really want to be saved spiritually. There are some people that don't really want to be made whole spiritually. They're happy with their halfway measure of serving God. And they're happy with just giving God lip service with their time and with their efforts. And just giving Him the leftovers and the scraps of their life in service to Him. What do we conclude here? We serve an awesome God. We serve an awesome God because He is so powerful. As we've seen, He's the master of quality. He does everything excellently. He's the master of distance and space. It doesn't matter whether He's in heaven or He's on earth. Jesus knows what's going on in our lives. He's also a master of time and infirmity. It doesn't matter how long we might have had a condition, God can change that. Time is not of the essence with respect to Jesus or God and their ability to make corrections. And that's true physically. It's also true spiritually. God's concerned about our physical needs and welfare. You read about Jesus, and so often you hear, you read in the Gospels that he had compassion on those that he encountered with their diseases and their infirmities, and he healed them. So likewise, we can take comfort in the fact that when we have afflictions here on this earth, Jesus is concerned about that. He's aware of it. Finally, he's concerned about our spiritual needs, which is even more important and is of even more concern. There are people that want to believe that what within God's nature is, he's looking for people he can zap and send to hell. That's their idea. And they're looking for people to step out of line. Oop, got them. Nothing could be further from the truth. You read the book of Ezekiel. You read Peter saying that it is that God does not desire that anyone should perish, that all should come to repentance. God doesn't want to send anyone to hell, but his justice is going to demand that he do just that. God would like nothing more than all of mankind to go to heaven. Unfortunately, mankind has said, sorry, we're not interested. So the question we leave with you here this morning, are you interested? Are you interested in making sure that when it comes time for you to depart this life, whether it's today, tomorrow, next week, next year, or whenever, that you're ready to stand before him in judgment, that you've had the atoning blood of Jesus applied to you and having had your sins washed away by having been baptized with him? We stand ready here this morning. The water's prepared. Ready to hear your confession, your acknowledgement that you wish to repent of your sins, and being able to be buried with him in baptism, to be able to put him on, be able to arise to walk in newness of life. Is that your desire this morning? We encourage you to do that. If you're here as well and you're Christian and you've done that, but you've just fallen away and allowed the affairs of this world to come between you and God, and you've decided you've had enough of that, and you want to put yourself back into a right relationship with God, but you feel like you need the prayers and the assistance of the congregation here, we stand prepared to help you in any way that we can, whether you fall into either of those two categories. We just ask that you let us know by coming to the front as we stand and sing.